The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Why are we so prone to believe in fringe beliefs, conspiracy theories, and questionable ideas with little to no basis in fact or science? Surveys have shown that about 20% of Americans believe that a Bigfoot creature exists. Nearly 500,000 people planned a failed attempt to storm Area 51 looking for aliens last summer. Now, people can believe what they want to believe, but this belief in science and rationality at the fringe can lead to a distrust of mainstream science, of government, and the academic pursuit of knowledge. And when we have a distrust of science and authority during a public health or safety emergency, My guest today has been a keen observer in our belief in the unprovable and fringe beliefs. Cultural historian and self-described tour guide to the weird Colin Dickey has documented our fascinations with many of these beliefs in his books about the spirit world, in his book The Morbid Anatomy and Anthology, and his acclaimed book from 2016, Ghostland, about alleged haunted places in America. His latest book tackles our beliefs in fringe theories in The Unidentified, Mythical Monsters, Alien Encounters, and Our Obsession with the Unexplained. It's published by Viking, and he joins me today to discuss our current mistrust of scientific information, as well as our penchants for finding one-size-fits-all explanations for the world and things we don't know about. Colin Dickey, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Now, before we talk about the unidentified, I want to get into the idea behind the unidentified, which is our susceptibility to unscientific beliefs. You know, a lot of our beliefs and fringe beliefs or conspiracy theories can be dismissed during normal times. But times like today with a pandemic, beliefs and theories that have no scientific basis can have real serious consequences. Why are we susceptible to these ideas with no truthful backing in them?
Yeah, you know, it's weird because before I started doing this research, I always thought, you know, you meet somebody with some kind of conspiracy belief or something that's, you know, plainly factually inaccurate. And the way to respond is just to tell them the truth, you know, show them the data, show them the scientific facts, and that'll convince them that, you know, their ideas are wrong. And I kept seeing that just not working. You know, we don't respond in that way. And one of the things I really wanted to do with this book and some of my other research is really try and get a better sense of why people cling to beliefs that, you know, just don't comport with the facts and, you know, or even when they're presented with evidence to the contrary, they still kind of cling to these beliefs and really double down. I think there's a really fundamental aspect of human nature that we all share, but for some people, it kind of goes haywire in this way, and we end up with these kind of weird conspiracy beliefs.
And now, with the internet, there's all sorts of ways of having, quote, proof, unquote, about these beliefs with unscientific belief because you can see it in print.
Yeah, exactly. It's weird. You know, one of the things I went back and researched is the story of Dorothy Martin, which I think is a good example of kind of how this stuff happens. And Dorothy Martin was a housewife in 1955 who began receiving messages from a Martian, or actually a Venusian from Venus, who told her that the world was going to flood on December 21st, 1955, and that a UFO was going to take her and her believers to safety right before it happened. So she gathers this little cult around her, and one of the people in the cult is actually a sociologist who's infiltrated the group to study them and write on them, and his name is Leon Festinger. And he writes a book about this, and he coins this term that we still use, which is cognitive dissonance, which I think really explains a lot of what you see. And basically, what Festinger sees is, obviously, or, you know, may come as a surprise to you, the world did not end on 1955. UFOs did not arrive and abscond with Dorothy Martin and her friends. You know, and some in the group kind of gave up. They said, okay, well, we were wrong. We got that wrong. I'm going to go back to my normal life. But the ones that remained really doubled down on the belief. You know, oh, we got the date wrong, but it's still happening. Or, you know, the message was a little garbled, but it's still true, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, what Festinger sort of sees is when we are confronted with a disconnect between our core beliefs and the facts on the ground, some of us will alter, you know, our beliefs. Some of us will say, okay, well, I got that wrong. I've got new information. I've got new facts, and I got to change my belief on this thing. But other people will double down on that belief because it's so much more primal and core to their central identity. And oftentimes that means discounting the facts or at least being sort of hostile to facts that don't fit that belief system. And that structure, I think, explains a lot of the kind of psychology of what's going on today. And, you know, even with this current pandemic and some of the conspiracy theories around that.
Of course, today we're hearing all sorts of crazy things, that COVID-19 was created as a bioweapon by the Chinese, or conversely, it was created by the pharmaceutical industry to basically gin up sales by selling us a vaccine, or that 5G can spread the virus, or wearing a mask can cause CO2 poisoning. That's perhaps the most strangest one out there to me. The one thing that can save us during a pandemic has a downside.
Oh, I'll do you one better. I saw this yesterday on the internet. There was a discussion about why the museums in New York City haven't reopened yet, and somebody suggested that this was all a plot so that Bill Gates could acquire the permanent collection of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, you know, which is, I think, the strangest conspiracy I've seen yet with regard to this. But, you know, I think what my sense of what happened with the COVID-19 stuff is, you know, back in the beginning, back in January and February, you know, there was a lot of uncertainty. There was a lot of stuff we didn't know. Scientists were kind of struggling to catch up. And as a result, people were kind of doing their best guess to make sense of what was going on. And, you know, people had different explanations for, you know, what was happening, where it came from, why it was so virulent, and, you know, whether or not these, you know, precautions were necessary or not. And in the coming months, a lot of that uncertainty was resolved. You know, we got better data. We understood a little bit better about transmission. We understood that masks actually worked really well. And a lot of people evolved and they said, okay, now we know better. We know what does and doesn't keep us safe. But some of these folks, their belief system mattered a lot more to them than the evolving nature of the facts as we understood them. And so that's where you start to get these conspiracy theories about, oh, you know, masks just make it worse. They somehow affect our CO2, or, you know, all this other garbage. It's sort of, again, it's this cognitive dissonance where the beliefs have become so primal and central that they're going to overtake any contradicting or countervailing facts that might suggest otherwise.
But do you think at the beginning it was a matter of filling the void, the fact that we didn't have a whole lot of useful information, so people found an explanation?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was, you know, I mean, for me, and I assume for a lot of people, you know, it was a legitimately scary time. You had no idea what was going to possibly get you sick or, you know, put you in the hospital or, you know, worse. And I think that when times are chaotic and scary like that, any explanation is better than no explanation. And so the people who seized upon, you know, these really outlandish paranoid conspiracy theories that this was a bioweapon or it was, you know, an attempt to, you know, implant us all with microchips via a vaccine or whatever. I mean, that stuff is scary, but it's less scary to some people than legitimately not knowing. You know, the uncertainty, the anxiety of chaos is so terrifying to some folks that they would rather envision a deeply malevolent nightmare conspiracy theory than embrace the fact that we just didn't have the answers.
Yeah. One more question about the idea of fringe theories. And, you know, they do seem more prevalent today. And you just touched on something I think I've always felt at my core is one of the reasons they flourish in certain times is during times of economic and cultural upheaval and unease. You know, I came of age in the 1970s and, you know, it was a time of really serious inflation. And all of a sudden, you know, the idea that for the first time that the organization man might not have an organization, his whole working career was beginning to change. And all sorts of things were happening in the 70s, as some of it fall out from the 1960s. And I remember it was also a time of super belief in psychics. And,
yeah,
you would see psychic predictions everywhere. And I always thought, as I, you know, came of age, there's some sort of relationship between economic and cultural change and the unease with those particular times that lead to the prevalence of belief in fringe theories.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. I think that absolutely hits the nail on the head. And you see, I think, when people are faced with uncertainty and chaos, anything that purports to offer a kind of key or code that unlocks everything, people are going to gravitate towards that, you know, and that's what a psychic offers. A psychic is there to tell you that, you know, everything can be known. You know, it's all going to be revealed. I mean, I'm a little younger than you, so, you know, I grew of age in the late 80s and the 90s during the, you know, the height of the AIDS crisis. So, again, you have another moment in time where there's a lot of chaos. There's a fair amount of uncertainty about what's happening. And, again, you have, you know, people running to, you know, quack medicine and other things because they feel that their lives are out of control. And they're looking for some kind of anchor, even if that anchor is sort of based on fiction.
My guest today is Colin Dickey. He's a cultural historian and author. His previous, most recent book prior to his new one was Ghostland, An American History in Haunted Places, which was critically acclaimed. And his new book is titled The Unidentified, Mythical Monsters, Alien Encounters, and Our Obsession with the Unexplained. It's published by Viking. Tell us how you decided to write this book. What was the starting point?
So the starting point for me really was, you know, the last 4 years, in the sense that we were just awash in a world of conspiracy theories, you know, swirling on, you know, on all sides at times, you know, and just trying to get a sense of where this had all come from. And so I decided, rather than try and write about the contemporary moment, that I would take a step back and try and understand kind of the long arc of history and see if I could better get to the point where I understood, you know, how we got to the moment that we're in now. So I, you know, rather than kind of, you know, going after the stuff that you see floating around Facebook too often, I chose some other topics. I, you know, I looked at, you know, aliens and UFOs. I looked at the lost continent of Atlantis and cryptids, which are, you know, Bigfoot and Loch Ness Monster and, you know, other quote unquote hidden animals. And, you know, so I sort of traced the evolution and the kind of history of these beliefs and how they changed over the years and kind of, you know, how they formed their way into our subconscious in a way that for me kind of gave me a better sense of understanding how we got to the current moment and what's actually happening right now before us.
I would imagine fringe beliefs have been there as long as there have been people. What's some of the oldest fringe beliefs that still carry on to this day?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, we've always had these beliefs. We've always had, you know, fringe beliefs. But what is interesting is that we used to have probably a more stable way of understanding them. And for a long time, you know, for better or worse, that was religion. You know, if you saw something weird in the sky, be it a comet or frogs falling from the heavens or whatever it was, you had an explanation for it. And that was, you know, whatever your religion was. You know, it was a sign from God. It was an omen. It was, you know, an indication that something terrible was happening or, you know, whatever, but there was a kind of mechanism for explaining those things. And what I found is that in the late 19th century, there's this moment, you know, it's a little earlier than that, maybe, you know, starting the beginning of the 19th century, but there's a gradual moment when, you know, science and religion as kind of two broadly speaking ways of understanding the world separate from one another, and they sort of posit themselves as being in sort of defined in opposition of one another, right? So, you know, now we have science basically arguing that it can explain the world and it has explanations for everything that happens. And you have religion kind of at the same time offering a sort of different view of the way things work. And, these two camps, they're kind of complementary in some ways. And in other cases, they're often at odds. And what happens, though, in that sort of great sorting out, I found, is that there's a bunch of stuff that gets left on the table in the middle, you know, that kind of falls in the crack between science and religion. And that's the stuff that I ended up kind of looking at in the book. So, you know, cryptids and, reigns of frogs and stuff like that, stuff that is part of the record. I mean, we have newspaper reports of the strange stuff happening. We have eyewitness reports, for better or for worse. You know, they're there and they want some kind of explanation. And science tends to sort of just dismiss them as, well, you know, it's a hoax or a fantasy or whatever. And, you know, religion doesn't really want to weigh in on all this stuff. And so what you're left with is this kind of group of, you know, what become, you know, these kind of fringe beliefs that kind of exist in this gray area in between.
Again, filling a void in a way.
Exactly. Yeah. And for some people, kind of providing that sense of wonder and the unexplained. I mean, some of us get that sense of wonder. We get it from religion. We get it from that kind of transcendental experience. And for others, we get it through science. I mean, you know, there's still a lot we don't know. There's still a lot of wonder out in, you know, how the universe works or, you know, what's at the bottom of the ocean and, you know, all that stuff. There's lots of kind of awe and mystery yet to be explored in these realms. But for another group of people, they get that sense of awe and mystery from you know, the unexplained and the unexplainable, you know, these kind of weird phenomenon that otherwise get kind of brushed under the rug.
Getting back to my question about the oldest fringe belief that survives to this day, what are the theories that stick best? You write that they have the mix of specificity and vagueness, but what are some of the theories that sort of demonstrate that?
Well, so a good example of that is the lost continent of Atlantis, right, which first appears in Plato's philosophy. Plato talks about it, but, you know, most people at the time kind of assume that he's talking about it in a kind of metaphorical way, like it's a kind of utopia or just a, you know, philosophical idea that he's kind of tossing around. And so that's how it's treated for centuries until the 1870s, when this guy, Ignatius Donnelly, he's a kind of failed businessman who goes into politics. He's elected to the House of Representatives for a few terms. And then, his political fortunes change and he's kind of looking for his third act. And he settles on this idea of Atlantis and he writes this book that becomes a huge bestseller in which he argues that Atlantis is not a, you know, a philosophical idea of Plato, but it was an actual real place. And it sank and, you know, there are traces of it everywhere. And so, yes, his book works because he's very good at imitating the language of archaeology and, anthropology. He's good at taking, you know, a few kind of unexplained facts or ideas and kind of spinning them into elaborate fantasies. But he's also good at selecting a topic in Atlantis that, you know, can't be verified one way or the other. I mean, we're never going to get there. We're never going to find that civilization. And so it's just abstract enough that it can be pretty much anything you want it to be. You know, if your vision of Atlantis may not look like my vision of Atlantis, but it kind of doesn't matter because we're never going to verify either of them anyway. So that's that mixture of something that is both very specific and uses, you know, a couple key specificities, but is also kind of vague and generic, so that each of us can kind of put into it whatever we want to. And that's one of the ways in which these beliefs really take off and they find root in our culture.
Now, was he doing it to con the people or was he a true believer?
I don't think he was. He wasn't intentionally trying to con people. No, I think he believed that this worked. I mean, it's interesting to see how it's not like this was like a lifelong passion for Ignatius Donnelly. Like he does kind of out of nowhere, he suddenly decides, oh, this is the thing I'm going to get interested in. But, you know, around that time, there was another guy who was not an archaeologist, but he got really interested in the story of Troy from Homer's The Iliad, and mm-hmm. he decides that he's going to find the archaeological record of the actual city of Troy. And even though he's not a trained archaeologist, he does find it. You know, he does find it, and, you know, archaeologists and historians have credited him with finding the remnants of Troy. And so I think Donnelly saw in Atlantis a sort of similar possibility that if you could prove that a heretofore kind of, you know, mythic or intangible place was actually real, then, you know, you could earn your place in history kind of, you know, forever. And so I think he was looking for a way to really put his name on the map, so to speak.
And this was probably about the same time when you're really starting to see excavations of Mesopotamia, of the Middle East, of ancient Palestine and the ancient state of Israel. And all of a sudden you're seeing this archaeological evidence of all the things that were taken on belief from everything from the Gilgamesh to the Bible.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it is a really fascinating time when a lot of really important new discoveries are being, you know, made for the first time. And in some sense, you can't really fault Donnelly for, you know, wanting to get in on that action. And I think if he had proposed this as a hypothesis and then let the chips fall where they may, that would have been one thing. But, you know, as much as it's sort of an earnest attempt to really kind of, you know, parse out what this would look like, you also kind of see a little bit of his kind of bad faith reasoning where he kind of cherry picks his evidence and he, you know, fudges the data a little bit, you know, and he kind of lets you think what you want to think without really pushing back and being more objective. And so you kind of see him trying to have it both ways. He both wants to be a legitimate person taken seriously, but he's also going to stack the deck in his favor.
My guest today is Colin Dickey. He's a cultural historian and author of the previous book, Ghostland, An American History in Haunted Places. And his new book is titled The Unidentified, Mythical Monsters, Alien Encounters, and Our Obsession with the Unexplained. It's published by Viking. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, I want to ask about extraterrestrials, because all of a sudden we're starting to see a whole new spate of UFO stories come out. you know, even the Air Force is saying, yes, we've seen some UFOs, unidentified flying objects. When did that whole idea of UFOs and extraterrestrial become a part of our culture? Is it something that's post-World War II, or does it go back much older?
Well, there are certainly stories of unexplained flying ships that predate World War II, and famously there are these, you know, well-known stories of over Chicago in the 1890s of these flying airships that nobody could quite explain. But that stuff kind of comes and goes, and it's really with the post-war era after World War II in the late 40s that it kind of cements itself in public consciousness. And that it starts with a sighting over Mount Rainier in Washington, where this guy Kenneth Arnold sees these flying kind of bat wing shaped, you know, flying ships that he follows, and he tries to figure out what they are. They don't really move like normal planes. So he lands. He goes immediately to the FBI because he thinks, well, maybe this is some sort of advanced, you know, military technology from the Soviet Union, and you know he's got to warn people. But the FBI is closed. The office is closed. So he does the next best thing. He goes to the newspapers, and he tells these journalists what he saw. And really curiously, you know, he describes them as bat wing shapes, but he says they were flying like discs skipped across the water. And somehow between him sort of using that as an analogy, you know, kind of figure of speech, within 24 hours, it's been garbled to he saw flying discs. So that's where this idea of flying saucers comes from. Is a kind of mistranslation of Kenneth Arnold's, his metaphor to describe these things. And so that becomes the thing that then kind of cements in people's idea. I mean, you can imagine a disc-shaped thing just doesn't exist in technology at the time, so that it must be something very strange and very new and unusual, and it sets off the what becomes the kind of UFO era in the United States and really across the world.
I want to ask you about, it's interesting because UFOs, as opposed to the cryptids, which you talk about in the book, things like Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, or Yetis, or, you know, various places in the deep woods and there are local versions everywhere. I think anywhere there are heavy, dense forests, you usually hear a story about some of these cryptids. But years ago, we were regularly seeing photographic evidence of some of these unidentified, like Nessie or Bigfoot. Now that everyone has a phone with a camera, we don't see that much. But on the other hand, we're seeing more about UFOs.
Right. It's a real conundrum for the people who, you know, really believe in, you know, something like Bigfoot because... Right. I mean, everybody's got a camera right now. You would think, you know, the old story was, you know, somebody's kind of hiking through the forest and they stumble across this Sasquatch or whatever. And, you know, it flees way too fast for them to get an image. But now it's really easy to get photographic evidence of this stuff. And the fact that we don't have it yet, I think is a problem for that community. And I, you know, I spent some time with some Bigfoot hunters in the Hudson Valley in New York. And they showed me some photographs of, you know, supposedly what they had seen. And it was, you know, really blurry, grainy, like, you know, super enlarged images of the forest to the point where I could barely make out what I was seeing. And I just thought, by now, I think you guys really should be able to come up with just a good, solid cell phone video of this stuff. And so I think it is a real problem that, you know, as the technology has gotten better, the cryptids seem to be getting even more elusive, which is counterintuitive to say the least. But you're right. I mean, you know, once again, we're really fascinated with UFOs. There was that declassified Air Force video of that, you know, flying gray blob on some pilot's, you know, radar. And so these things kind of wax and wane, and you'd think that would correspond to, you know, maybe, you know, the technological ability to capture this stuff on film, but it seems to really be independent of that.
I was wondering if, in some ways, is it a new way of creating myths that, you know, many of our longstanding myths, you know, we're talking about Joseph Campbell, you know, and that sort of idea, many of those have been destroyed by science. Is it a matter of creating something that is unexplained and can't be explained easily, so we create a story to suit it?
Oh, yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I think that one of the really fascinating things is what you're seeing here is a kind of a new form of blending myth with science. So, you know, a good example of that is Bigfoot or the Yeti or whatever you want to call it. You know, folklore across the globe, there are often stories in myth and folklore about what folklore is called the wild man, right? You know, a lot of cultures have this story about a figure, a kind of humanoid figure that's maybe a little larger than humans, and it's, you know, full of hair, and it's uncivilized. It doesn't speak, but it's this kind of hairy, distant cousin that lives on the edge of town. And there are lots of, you know, stories and folklore about this, about, you know, how this thing sort of comes into the community and that kind of stuff. So that existed long before the kind of modern age of the Sasquatch and Yeti. And what I think you see is people sort of rejuvenating that myth and reinventing it by giving it some specificity, by giving it some grainy photographs and some eyewitness accounts. But it's a way of reinvesting that myth with something contemporary, which gives it enough legwork to still have meaning. So it could still do the same thing that those older myths do. It's just, we're not going to call it a myth anymore. We're now going to call it a fringe belief.
You've investigated an awful lot of fringe beliefs in your book, The Unidentified. What's the strangest one you ran across?
Certainly one of the strangest things that I came across that I just could not come up with a good explanation for was what's known today as the Great Kentucky Meat Shower, which is this event that happened in 1876 where in Olympia Springs, Kentucky, meat fell from the sky. Chunks of meat sort of rained out of nowhere. And, you know, this was something that was documented, that there was a woman and her grandson who witnessed this. And subsequently, there was all this meat all over the ground that, you know, the townspeople kind of gathered up and they preserved some of it. And, you know, this is an old woman. She was obviously not a hoaxer, you know, not in it for the publicity or anything like that. And, you know, they couldn't figure out where the meat had come from. There were some extremely brave souls who even ventured to try and take a bite of it and see if they could identify it by taste, which I don't recommend. this event was debated in scientific journals. You know, very, you know, reputable scientists and biologists all tried to figure out exactly where the meat had come from and, you know, how it got there. And, you know, there are a lot of different hypotheses. Some of them are stronger than others. But, you know, I never felt like I got a clear and unequivocal definition or explanation for why this thing happened. And yet, you know, it's there. You know, it's still part of the record. And, you know, one way or another, I mean, I think we have to admit that something happened.
And there are people still trying to figure it out.
Right, exactly. And, you know, for one of the best parts of the research trips for me was I went to Transylvania University in Kentucky, where the last extant piece of meat from the meat shower is in a jar in a museum. And, you know, I got to meet the curator and sort of wrestle with this question of what the heck is it in this jar sitting in front of us and what does it all mean?
The name of the book is The Unidentified. Colin Dickey, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on. This was a lot of fun.
Colin Dickey is a cultural historian and author of the acclaimed book Ghostland, An American History in Haunted Places. His latest book is titled The Unidentified, Mythical Monsters, Alien Encounters, and Our Obsession with the Unexplained. It's published by Viking. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.